Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 5th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome two astronomers, Vox Pop favorite Bob Berman, joined by Vox Pop favorite Valerie Rapson. And Valerie of the Dudley Observatory, Bob, you know, as an author and editor and a regular go-to expert on astronomy, if you have a question about things like black holes, maybe you want to go take a look around Titan, maybe you would like to touch the sun, all of those things can be discussed. Oh, and Bob brought a meteorite. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us if you wish. It's voxpopwamc.org. voxpopwamc.org. Valerie and Bob, astronomy today. We kick off after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson, chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. Her dissertation focused on the chemical composition and structure of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. We also have Bob Berman here, who is an author, widely read author on astronomy, and the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But that number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, I got to tell you, there's some excitement here. And most of us in the newsroom are very thrilled about what Bob brought, and that is, it's a heavy rock, I'll tell you that. Where'd this thing come from?
It came from Argentina. It landed about 500 miles to the northwest of Buenos Aires.
I think the answer is it came from space, right?
Well, yeah, originally it came from space. It's an asteroid.
It's so cool, man.
Although anything that comes through our atmosphere and lands, whether it's a bit of a comet or anything, it's always called a meteor or a meteorite once it lands. But yeah, it's originally an asteroid.
It's about the size of an orange, perhaps, although the shape of a pear is more like it. And it's got to be 3, 4, 5 pounds. There it is hitting the table. What's it made out of?
Nickel and iron. It's an octahedrite.
And that's a standard makeup of...
Well, some of them are stony. Some of them are stony metal. There's different compositions and different parts of the solar system. The outer solar system, some of them have very characteristic, distinctive compositions. This one, obviously, is nickel iron.
It's... how can you tell? I mean, if you had some kid come in with a rock they found in the neighborhood, how do you make sure it's a real meteorite?
Okay, a couple of initial things. One, it should be heavier than a regular rock of its size. This is. That's a quick thing.
It certainly is.
Secondly, most meteorites will pull out a magnet. So if you have a magnet here, just see if it goes clunk, if they pull on each other. That's a good sign. Now we're heading in a real, genuine meteorite direction. But then the dead giveaway are these depressions that look as if it were made of soft clay, as if your thumb kept pressing into it, you'd be making thumbprints. And in fact, they're called thumbprints, although the technical name is regmaglypts for you Scrabble players,
right.
G-L-Y-P-T. These are regmaglypts, and you don't see these on earthly rocks.
See them on earthly rocks?
I don't know. Valerie will know the answer.
Well, when the meteorites come in, they get heated. And when you have that metal, it kind of compresses as it hits the atmosphere and gets heated up. So you create these dents in the rocks.
But we could, given enough heat and pressure, fabricate these.
Potentially. You could fabricate something that looks like the outside. It's really the inside that you can't fabricate. If you slice this rock open, you're going to have what you call a Windmanstätten pattern. Basically, these lines in the iron that only occur when iron cools over thousands and thousands of years. And we cannot replicate that in a lab.
Yeah, you don't get that in earthly rocks. They look like a tic-tac-toe pattern. But you'd have to damage this, unfortunately, to do that test. You'd have to slice it, drop some nitric acid on it, and you'd get this strange alien-looking geometrical tic-tac-toe pattern, Widmansen pattern, but we're not going to do that.
This is obviously a fairly massive meteorite. How many of these of this size are in existence in collections?
Oh, in collections? I couldn't even know. Thousands.
Yeah,
really?
Tons. Oh, yeah. We found quite a few. Yeah.
Where do you find most of them?
In the Antarctic.
Mm-hmm. Ah, because no development, nothing?
Well, also, you can tell it. In a particular state, like in New York State, I happen to know there have only been 12 meteorites found in the entire history of our state.
But there must be more.
Yeah, I'm certain. Many more that haven't been found. But in the Antarctic, a black rock, and they're black because of the fusion crust that forms on the way through the Earth, in the midst of all this snow and ice, sticks out. There's no reason for a rock to be sitting on that snow and ice. So researchers actually drive around in snowmobiles and harvest them. That's the place to where you have a hope of actually finding them on the ground.
Very, very interesting. Well, there are some interesting news items pertaining to space. The first one I saw was about our sun-skimming spacecraft from NASA. It is the...
Parker.
The Parker. And it made some interesting observations. At least, I don't know when they happened, but they were talking about them this week all over the news. They measured bursts of energetic particles never before seen on such a small scale. They've also have evidence of a dust-free zone encircling the sun. I didn't know there was a dust-full zone circling the sun, so maybe we ought to explain that. Bob, you wrote the book, The Sun's Heartbeat.
Yeah, the zodiacal light, sometimes called the zodiacal light, and I'm not really sure. What do you prefer of those two pronunciations?
I have always said zodiacal.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the correct or not.
I like that better. Okay. The zodiacal light is this kind of Milky Way-like glow that's cone-shaped, that is wide on the horizon, slants, and then gets more and more narrow as it looks up from the sky. If you live in a really dark place, not Poughkeepsie or Albany, but really out in the boonies, as many of us do, during certain months of the year, March is best. Right after sunset, and I say March because that's when the zodiac makes its most vertical slant up from the horizon, you'll see a glow. And that glow are the dust particles you were just talking about that are in the plane of our solar system, because after all, there's lots of pieces of dust left over from asteroid collisions and comet things that have fallen off comets is out there. But now we find that as the dust orbits the sun, and normally gets closer and closer to the sun thanks to something called, and I've been waiting 20 years to say this, the Poynting-Robertson effect, P-O-Y-N-T-I-N-G, Poynting-Robertson effect, which is sunlight on dust grains makes the dust grains lose energy as they orbit.
Ah.
So what happens when you lose energy? You orbit closer and closer to the sun. And so we expect to see lots of dust there. Well, the Parker probe just found big regions near the sun that's dust-free. Why? Because when you get too close, the dust, I won't say melt because you can't have liquid in space, but let's say evaporates, turns to gas, and then it clears it of the dust. So that's a discovery this week.
They say in this AP News item, they have found so much dust in this region that it actually, one grain pierced one of the viewfinders of the instrument.
Yeah.
Amazing. That's a lot of dust. The Parker Solar is observatory?
Parker Solar Probe, I believe.
Has come within 15 million miles of the sun. It'll get closer over the next 6 years. How close before it's all
4
done?
Million miles.
Mm-hmm.
It's
really?
By 2024, it'll be only 4 million miles from the sun. And that's only about a tenth the distance that Mercury is.
How long can it live that close to the sun?
I would have thought it should get out of there and quit while it's ahead even now. But apparently, no, it's going to go closer and closer.
Yeah. It's got a nice heat shield on the front. It's got this carbon-carbon fiber and a reflective outer layer that should protect it for at least 10 years or so.
Very exciting. Now, Valerie, you sent this article from space.com.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, our number here is 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. And this is quoting from space.com. A Chinese-led team discovered a stellar mass black hole that appears to be 68 times heftier than the Earth's sun, nearly three times bigger than the heaviest such objects should be, according to current thinking. Explain.
Yeah, so these new black holes that we're finding are kind of borderline what we call intermediate mass black holes. They're bigger than the standard black holes that form after a star dies and explodes, but they're much, much smaller than something at the middle of a galaxy. And it was interesting to read the article because they seem very puzzled about, you know, where this black hole came from and how it formed. But the first thing I thought of is it must be a merger. You might have heard that, you know, a couple of years ago we discovered the gravitational waves. Two black holes combine, they make a bigger one. This is probably an example of that, but in our own Milky Way galaxy. And they just formed many, many years ago, and we're finally now just discovering the object.
And it's relatively close.
Yeah, I think something like 13,000 light years. Which, yeah, you know, sounds like a really far distance, but compared to everything else, it's very close by.
But I wouldn't believe it.
Why?
Necessarily.
You wouldn't believe what?
Uh-oh.
Well, that 14,000 light year distance is iffy. And there's some other evidence that it might only be half the distance. And here's what's interesting. If it's only 7,000 light years away, everything else about it changes
smaller
too, including its mass.
Yeah.
So it might only be, back to Roberto Duran again, it might only be...
yes.
10 solar masses. It's not for sure that it's this weird 68 solar masses that we think, but it might be.
Now, to put it in perspective, the black hole at the center of our galaxy and
most galaxies,
it's huge.
Yeah,
4 million solar masses.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here to answer your questions. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here to answer your astronomy questions. And we're about to jump on the phones. This email came in from Laura. I'll tell you, Bob, we get asked this question every year. Can you explain the concept of the shortest day being December 7th rather than the winter solstice?
Essentially, I always try to think of a way to explain it without having a chalkboard or a whiteboard, because with that I can really do it easily and well. But on the radio, what the concept really is we have a time system using clocks that tick evenly. Every second is the same. But we have a sun that reaches the meridian every day and therefore sets every day, rises every day, ahead of or behind our clocks, because Earth's orbit is elliptical. And that means, according to Kepler's second law, that Earth speeds up and slows down. And that means that the sun seems to speed up and slow down in terms of having an even spacing from where it is against the sky day after day. Mm. That means that our clocks are not going to always keep up where the sun is. And that means that the time, because that's what we're talking about, the time in which our clocks register sunset or sunrise isn't necessarily going to be on where you'd expect it to be. So because of that, so happens the earliest sunset for our latitude is around December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. We're talking about right now. This is the darkest afternoon. That means it gets brighter. That means people who are like already depressed by winter, it's going to be, by the time you get to the start of winter on December 21st on the solstice, we're going to have about 5 minutes more daylight
The
afternoon. Mm-hmm. So, but the
reason to live, eh?
But the mornings are getting gloomier, and it's not till the first week of January that we get to our latest sunrise or darkest morning.
All right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here to answer your questions. John in Hyde Park. John, you're on.
Hi, gang. Thanks for taking my call. I understand that the distance to the solar bodies and the expansion of the universe is measured by the Doppler effect on the light. Now, I wonder if anybody's ever done a study to see if light actually loses energy as it travels those billions of miles.
Paul Dirac would have loved that question. Paul Dirac, right?
Yep.
Because back in the 1930s, that was one of his things. Maybe light loses energy. Maybe light loses speed. Maybe it's not always 186,282.4 miles per second. Maybe after a while it gets tired. And if there, light gets tired, then everything else we think we know about the universe, the age of the universe, how long it's taken light from galaxies to get here, throw that all away. We have to start from scratch.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
So your idea has been looked at now for a whole human lifetime, but every experiment we do and every way we measure it shows that that doesn't happen, and light is the constant that Einstein said it was.
Well, I'm sure that the speed is, it can't lose velocity, but it could still lose energy if it is, in fact, aging over the billions of years it takes for the light to get to the planet. So,
okay, but if it lost energy...
How would they study that?
Here's how we'd study that. Let's say we use a telescope and we look at the Andromeda Galaxy. Well, the light that we're seeing has been traveling for 2.5 million years. Let's measure those photons of different wavelengths, and we know the frequency, the wavelengths of the photons should have in a lab. Let's measure them and see if indeed they've lost energy, which actually means the wavelengths have stretched out and the frequency has changed, has decreased. That's what energy means, actually. Yeah. So has that happened? No, hasn't happened, no matter how distant the object is. So it's just not happening. I like the idea, though.
Thanks, John. Our number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Paul in Williamstown. Paul, you're on.
Hey, Valerie. I've got a question for you. I've got a vague memory, probably from reading too much science fiction, that the solar system's planets that we know now were not like this in the beginning, and that we had a giant sort of accretion disk around our sun, and these planets not only slowly formed out of that disk, but then were cannonated into by other things and broken up and made into other planets. Do you have a quick synopsis of what the last, 10 billion years of our solar system's been like?
Right, yeah. Well, you've got it pretty much right. You know, the sun formed about 4.5 to 5 billion years ago. You've had this accretion disk of gas and dust and material. And over time, that material stuck together and formed our planets. So the planets may have migrated in that time. Maybe they didn't form exactly where they are today, but that's the general idea. Stuff starts to stick together. You can grow your terrestrial planets and your gas giant planets. Now, shortly after that, you're also thinking of the late heavy bombardment, when a lot of the planets, especially the terrestrial ones, were hit by the leftover debris, all of these asteroids that never quite made it into the planets. And a lot of the craters that we see on the moon and other planets today are from that time frame. So I think you've got
correct. Yeah. How much more? Is that settled down? Are we in some kind of period there's so much less?
Yeah, the late heavy bombardment was just, very short time scale on astronomical time scales. We're talking maybe tens of thousands of years, something like that. So there are definitely still asteroids out there and things colliding with other planets today, but, not nearly like it used to be.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons, if I may add, that studying the moon is so much fun. Even with the smallest telescope, you look at the moon and there is a history book. You can turn page after geological page just by looking at different parts of the moon. And you see the Imbrian period, which created Mare Imbrium, this big circular basin. And then you can see the Eratosthenian. I'm glad just to be able to pronounce that.
Yeah, thank you.
A period. And there's this crater that's a beautiful crater near the lunar Apennines, but it has no white ray system coming out of it. So that means it's not recent. Mm-hmm. So that happened during a bombardment period about 3.2 billion years ago. No, more like 3.8 billion years ago, but not the most recent one. What's the most recent one? The Copernican period. And there you have craters that are marked by white ray systems that come out of them. Yeah. The most recent period of bombardment, which was a lesser period, just like Valerie said, it was that heavy bombardment was already easing up, and there were very few. And since then, almost nothing has happened on the moon, relatively speaking. It's been very, very light, and also on Earth. So, and you can see the record. On Earth, you can't, because we've got too much erosion erasing everything. On the moon, a little $60 telescope will show you all those eras, and you can see the different marks left by them. And if you read up on this, the how they look different, craters with white rays coming on them, craters without white rays. You see the whole thing. It's so exciting.
Paul, thank you for the call. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here today. It's astronomy on the program. Valerie, you mentioned that there are still asteroids out there, and mm-hmm. they still come around. Has anybody ever taken a picture of an asteroid strike on the moon?
Ooh, so I don't know if we have seen any on the moon. I don't know, Bob, if you've heard some, correct me. We've definitely seen, you know, comets and asteroids hit the gas giant planets before.
Jupiter was
a famous one. Yeah.
Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Yeah. Are there any more recent ones that you recall? I don't know that we have.
Now, and that was great with my old panel, David Levy, mm-hmm. being the co-discoverer, and Caroline Shoemaker.
Right.
I think it was Caroline, or maybe it was, Shoemaker-Levy. But but during that last lunar eclipse, just mm-hmm. some months ago, several people saw, and I think there was a photograph of a bright point of light on part of the moon
on the
eclipse shadow. So obviously it was hit during mm-hmm. that eclipse. So it must happen. And there are periodic reports of that. So we believe that, yes, there are still impacts. It's just that they're few and far between. And it's news when it happens.
Right. We're not always looking at the right time.
Yeah. If you'd been around 3.8 or 4 billion years ago, it would not have been news.
I was around 2 billion years ago, but not quite that far.
It's just feeling that way after that last snowstorm.
The area now in our solar system where there are a lot of rocks out mm-hmm. there, right? How far out are they?
Well, most of the asteroids are in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. So that's, you know, it's not that far away. Two to three times.
Way outside.
So then you're looking at the Kuiper Belt. We're talking, you know, 4 or 5 billion miles away, kind of out where Pluto is. And those objects pretty much stay there, unless they collide with each other and get kicked out. You know, those rocks all kind of stay in their belts.
Are they leftovers from the creation of the solar system?
Everything is leftovers from the creation. Very rarely do we actually see an object come in that's not from our solar system.
Do we know why, in fact, there is this belt of asteroids so relatively close to us mm-hmm. when there is a massive quantity on the outside of the solar system? What mechanism caused the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter?
The answer is always gravity, right? Gravity always causes these things.
And it was Jupiter that interfered.
Yes.
A planet couldn't accrete there because Jupiter's mass, Jupiter's 318 times more massive than Earth. So with this kind of heavy gravitational and tidal presence, you couldn't form a stable planet. So mm-hmm. so the stuff that was there remained just potential planet-forming accretion material, never worked together. Although when I was first into astronomy as a kid, they used to then believe, a lot of people, that it was a planet that blew up, maybe because there was an advanced civilization with nuclear war.
Ah.
And, you know, that was making mm-hmm. the rounds back when I was a kid. That was a little more dramatic.
Are there lesser asteroid belts, say, between Jupiter and Saturn?
No,
there really isn't. It's all concentrated in those two regions. And there are asteroids that come, you know, close to Earth. We've got our near-Earth asteroids. There's Trojan asteroids that follow, that trail Jupiter around the sun. So there are rocks elsewhere. It's just that primarily there's a nice gravitational balance between Jupiter and the sun and the outer planets that put the rocks in those few spaces.
I was watching a show the other night. I think it was on Nostradamus, because that's the sort of weird stuff I do. And, it was a show about the end of the world. Prophecies of the mm-hmm. end of the world. And, you know, his whichever way the wind blows, you can interpret these quatrains. However, they tried to make the connection with asteroid Bennu, is it? Is that mm-hmm. the one?
Yeah.
And allegedly will have a fairly close pass in 2170 or something like that. What are the odds that thing will smash into the Earth?
Apophis, that's the bad one.
Oh, really?
It'll come around 2026 and then another 6 years later, and then again in the 2040s again.
Well, that's not the one they were talking about on the show.
Yeah, but this is the worst one.
Really?
Apophis is the
That's pretty soon.
Oh, that's very soon.
By the way.
And there was even a small chance, it's since gone away with more precise orbital parameters, that it would even hit us. And it still might in the early 2030s. Still like one chance in a quarter million. It won't happen, but it's going to come close as our orbiting satellites, our geostationary satellites. That is within 22,300 miles. That's close.
The point made on this show was that this asteroid is that's making a close pass, it'll get close enough that the Earth will make make a change to its path.
Right. So the one you're thinking of, Bennu, is being visited by OSIRIS-REx, the NASA mission.
Right.
So that mission is there, and when this asteroid comes by, we will see a slight gravitational change, which is going to change the chance that it'll hit Earth, for better or for worse. We don't really know which way it's going to go. I think right now it only has like a 0.5% or maybe even less chance of hitting Earth, but we're monitoring it just in case that changes for the worst for
us.
But
we do know that at some point a big one will hit. They have hit before. There are plenty of rocks out there, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure, of course, of course. Happened before, will happen again. We had some of the biggest mass extinctions have been caused by that. Most famously, the 66 million year ago, what used to be called the KT, Cretaceous Tertiary event, but they've changed the name on us.
I thought there was a bigger one earlier.
Well, there was 251 million years ago, that was the Great Dying, the Permian extinction, but they're still not sure whether that was an impact, which it could have been, or the Siberian Traps, a strange name for like super volcanoes that erupted and put a lot of carbon into the sea at that time. So that one, which was the worst extinction of all, still has a not sure etiology.
And yet life persists. Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing? Speaking of life persisting, and we'll get right back to the phones. I know I digress here. 800-348-2551. Life persisting. There was an article in the New York Times a couple of days ago titled, "Go Ahead, Take a Spin on Titan." And this is by Dennis Overby. And he says, "How weird can nature get? Try Titan, Saturn's largest moon, where it rains gasoline, soot drifts down like snow, and is mounted into dunes by nitrogen winds. Rivers have carved out canyons through mountains of frozen hydrocarbons. Layers of ice float on subsurface oceans of ammonia. And yet there are those scientists who say there may be life as we don't know it possible on a place like that."
Right.
Dennis Overby came to my wedding. We used to be pals when he lived in Woodstock.
Well, that's not helpful to the conversation.
Okay, so to the conversation, when we say life as we don't know it, you don't know what you don't know. Unfortunately, but if carbon is necessary, I mean, it's the only place with liquid. That's the thing on the surface. There is no liquid on any surface of any moon or any planet except for Titan. So there is an atmosphere that's a little thicker than ours, made of nitrogen, just like ours is 78% nitrogen. Titan's is even more than that nitrogen, except the instead of being water, the liquids are essentially methane. You know, our natural gas, propane.
Hmm.
So we're talking about liquid propane and methane, CH4. So you're talking about liquids that you really wouldn't want to take a dip in.
How big is Titan?
It's about 3,000 miles,
that's right,
I think.
3,000.
That's a big moon.
3,050 miles, yep. And it's third.
It's bigger than Earth's moon,
after,
for sure.
After Ganymede and Callisto, I think Titan's third. Yeah.
Well, I encourage any listeners who are interested in this to go to this New York Times article, because there's a map. Now, Cassini has mapped this moon, and you can actually drag across the circular image and go right around Titan. It's very cool. And they have named things with
Krakow. What's the name of that sea?
Kraken Mare from the South Pole, or was it the North
strange,
Pole?
Strange.
All right, let's grab one more call, and then we'll take a break. 800-348-2551. Paul in Marbles, Massachusetts. Paul. Hello. All right.
Hello, this is Paul from Florence, Massachusetts.
Oh, it says Marbles here, which would be a great name for a town, right?
There is no Marbles, Massachusetts. But one comment and one quick question. Comment is, years ago, Bob Berman, you suggested, don't get a telescope for your son at Christmas, get binoculars. I got binoculars, and we've been looking at wildlife and birds ever since. It's beautiful.
Nice.
Great.
So thank you. Secondly, my question is, could there be black holes massive enough to be a source of dark energy and dark matter?
Well, that's kind of tricky. So first of all, we don't know what dark matter and dark energy is, but they're not necessarily tied to black holes. So we know that dark matter interacts gravitationally with stuff, but it doesn't seem to, go around black holes or anything like that. It actually seems to be at the edges of our galaxy, more at the center. Dark energy, who knows what that is. So far, there's no direct link to the two of them in black holes, but we still don't really know what we're talking about here.
Yeah, apples and oranges. Think of a black hole as a place where everything is crushed dense, very, very dense material, the opposite of a hole. Just think of where a star has collapsed to be, you know, we're talking about 15,000 times denser than steel. Think of that as a black hole. Then what has that got to do with dark energy, which seems to be an anti-gravity force that empty space has? So what does that got to do with a crushed material? Nothing. Okay, what about dark matter, which is just an unknown, something that does have gravitational power, but doesn't have anything to do with light, apparently. So these are all unknowns, as Valerie said. Unknowns, and with black holes, you don't have an unknown. You have a known, which is super crushed, lots of gravity.
Right.
So, you know, different creatures.
All right, Paul, thank you. We have to take a break here. Bob Berman is here, Valerie Rapson as well. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. You know who that is, Zach the Engineer? It's Frank Marino. That's a Canadian rocker right there, right? You don't hear that on public radio all that often. Mahogany Rush, right? Good thing, too. It's Vox Pop, and it is Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, also Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. Bob's an author and a fabulous human being.
Chop liver.
Right, exactly. Where's your PhD, see? All right, back to the phones we go. Stephen in Gansford. Stephen.
Hey, Dr. Bob, Ray, how are you?
I'm all right. How you doing?
Good. So a recent caller asked, and there was a brief discussion about our knowledge, our cosmologic understanding based on the possibility of the speed of light slowing over time and distance. And the argument I heard, a recent experiment, I don't know how recent, I had read about, involved gasification of sodium and then bombardment with multidirectional lasers to slow the sodium atoms down to a very slow rate and hence became very cold, and then passing light through that chamber, and it was noted that the light slowed down.
Has
in
to.
That chamber.
It has to. Light goes slower through denser media like glass or water. It goes only 75% of its previous speed when you shoot it through water and it's similar to a glass. But you know what's controversial about that? I know I'm just jumping in here. I didn't even let the caller finish their question.
Yeah. You inferred my question.
Good.
Genius.
Well, you'll always read that light travels at a slower speed through denser media. That famous speed of light is only in a vacuum of space, and that never varies. But through a denser medium such as water or glass, it goes slower. But here's the funny thing. It's not really going slower. What's happening is that as each photon of light encounters an atom, that atom absorbs that light and then re-emits it. And then it travels to the next atom in that medium, and then it gets absorbed and re-emitted. And each one of these requires a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. So that the amount of time it takes the light to actually traverse, let's say, a pane of glass, is longer than it would if there hadn't been any glass in the way. But it really technically hasn't slowed down. What's happened is it just keeps hitting stuff, gets absorbed, gets re-emitted, and then goes on to the next. But in between atoms, it's actually traveling at the good old-fashioned speed that it had gone previously, if anyone cares, which
that
nobody
does,
should, actually.
Well, Stephen and Gansmore cares.
I'm never going to say this again.
That does not then influence our understanding of age of universe based on Doppler effects of light? And
No, nothing to do with Doppler shift here. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Stephen. We appreciate the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today on the program, Jim and Adams Mass. Jim, are you in Marvel Mass or Adams Mass?
Adams Mass, sir.
All right, man.
Yay,
you're on.
Ray.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. Yay, Ray. And good afternoon to Dr. Berman and Dr.
Rutherford. There you go, Jim. Well played.
There you go. I'm just asking a very ordinary, everyday question you get perhaps is you have some lunar or solar eclipses we can expect coming up in the next year or so.
Yes, that's thing since I've been leading tours now to solar eclipses since March 7th, 1970. And the next one coming up, lunar eclipses are another story. Lunar eclipses are sort of, you know, they go on and on and on.
Dime a dozen.
Half the world sees them when they happen. So that's why we've all seen lunar eclipses. But if you ask a group of people...
I couldn't see the last one here. It was too cloudy.
Yeah. But if you ask people, how many of you have ever seen a total solar eclipse, you'll get fewer people because for any given location, they only happen once every 360 years. And the next
half
one,
the people went blind looking at it, right?
Fortunately not. So the next one's December 14th of 2020. That'll be in Patagonia. That'll be followed. The next one after that will be December 4th of 2021. That'll be in the Antarctic. We're going. We're bringing people down.
Oh, cut it out.
That'll be fun.
You're going to the Antarctic for that.
I just learned this weekend that apparently I am. Yep.
Really?
I was just invited.
And you're
to
taking
be...
people on one of your tours?
Yes.
Amazing. And how do people find out about that?
And the tours, but the one that's soonest is not an eclipse. It's the Northern Lights coming up just in March. How they'd find out about it, what it costs, what the dates are. SpecialInterestTours.com.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Jim, you have a follow-up there, sir?
Well, I guess you don't have any lunar eclipses are coming up in the next year or so now.
Any lunar eclipses? The next one, let's say.
Unfortunately, this year, they're going to be so partial that they'll be penumbral. A lunar eclipse is penumbral when the moon only goes into our outer shadow and nothing happens. When you look up at the moon, it looks just like any other full moon. It looks so disappointing that about 27 years ago, when I took over as the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, the first thing I did was we will no longer ever mention penumbral lunar eclipses.
Right, can you mention an umbral then?
Because people will go out, look up, and they'll think nothing. They'll see that nothing happened, and they'll be disappointed. Mm-hmm. They'll be turned off to astronomy.
Right, when's the next full one then?
Not this year. We're not going to have one this year. And I don't, unlike the total solar eclipses where I can see them mapped out in my head going up for the rest of the century, I don't keep track of lunar eclipses because...
You're bored by them, but I love them. I love the way the moon gets red or dark brown.
Yep. I think there is one in 2021. I want to say April or May. Double check me on that, but I'm pretty sure there is one, you know, in about a year and a half or so.
All right, Jim, thank you for the call. You know, but he's right. It's always cloudy around here when a big event happens. It drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. I remember only a couple of weeks ago there was supposed to be this big meteor storm, 15 minutes of it was in the news, and I don't know.
Yep.
Of course, cloudy and rainy here. So did anybody find out if it was any good?
You're sounding like me now. You've been hanging out with me too long.
Well, no, I said, all right, kids, it's between 11:15 and 11:45. We're going to stay up. We're going to see this meteor storm. It's supposed to be a couple of hundred in a 15-minute span. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't see anything.
Just so you know, the next predicted meteor storm will be the night of November 18th in 2099.
Well, this is the thing. This is why the clouds have ruined it for me.
Right.
All right, let's go to Paul in Cohoes. Paul, you're on.
Hello. I have a question about the intergalactic medium. The particle density in the intergalactic medium is the lowest compared to the interstellar and the interplanetary.
Right.
But the intergalactic medium is apparently the hottest of the three. Can you explain why it's hotter?
Well, it's hotter in a sense of how much energy it possesses, you know, and there's a difference between, you know, measuring temperature and measuring energy and things like that. So the particles, they may have a great deal of energy, but they're not necessarily hot and they're very low density. So you don't feel the warmth in a sense.
Do you know what we mean by heat? This is very simple. Heat means speed, the speed of atoms.
Right.
That's the only thing heat means.
So there might be three atoms, but they're going really quickly.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, that's the difference.
And that is the average density of material in the universe. It's 5 atoms per cubic meter or centimeter, cubic centimeter. Do you remember, Valerie?
I want to say centimeter.
5 atoms.
Intergalactic, I think, is per cubic meter.
Okay.
So it's probably cubic meter also. 5 atoms per cubic meter, that's the average density, not much. As for temperature, that just means how fast they're going.
Right.
In fact, even if you go to, I think human, I'll check on this when I go back, but I believe at body temperature, 98.6, our body's atoms are jiggling at roughly 1,000 miles an hour. If you run a fever, they're jiggling about 4 miles an hour faster.
Uh-huh.
So as an alternative to going to the doctor and saying, I have a fever, my temperature is 102, you could say, my body atoms are 1,004 miles an hour, and it's making you feel really, really bad.
Okay.
Because that's really what's happening. That's what temperature is.
All right, I'll try that the next time the kids are sick and
see what happens.
Ah, your atoms are moving faster, Vivian. John and Kanan, you're on. John. John, that sounds terrible. Okay. Apparently, John is doing his own emergency broadcasting test. Sorry, John. Try again. Let's go to Robin in Niskayuna. Robin.
I don't know where you live, but where I live, it's the light pollution that prevents me from being able to enjoy the beautiful meteor showers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't that what the scientists find as well? Heavy light pollution prevents us from being able to see those meteor showers?
Yeah, a lot of the meteors that we normally see are very, very faint, you know, compared to the stars or the moon glow or the light pollution. So if you really want to see a good meteor shower, you got to get away from the cities. You got to go out to the park, you know, and just look where there are no lights to see the best, for sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Now, one of these space magnates is launching these little tiny satellites in
SpaceX.
String.
Terrible, terrible. Mm-hmm.
And,
terrible.
Yeah. It's annoying you astronomer types, right?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's great what they're doing. They're trying to provide internet for the world and things like that. But they get in the way of our pictures. When we take long exposure pictures by pointing a telescope at a galaxy and staring at it for hours on end, when a satellite passes through our view, it makes this nasty streak across the image. And the more satellites and objects we have orbiting the Earth, the more streaks we get. And in certain cases, it's to the point where we can't do any science with the images. There's too much erroneous light and artifacts in our pictures.
Looks like prison bars, actually.
Yeah,
in front of the image. And it's going to get worse because there's a number of companies, not just SpaceX now, that have already launched the first bunch and more are coming. What's going to happen is there will be more visible satellites, not even just photography, just to the eye. Then there are stars in the sky, and that's coming up in just a few years. So the only good news, because I don't want to leave this on a bummer, is there is good news, and that is you only see satellites during the first 90 minutes of nightfall and the final 90 minutes before dawn. In the middle 4 hours of the night surrounding midnight or 1 a.m. during daylight saving time months, you can't see them anyway, okay. So they'll be invisible.
All right, let's now try John and Kanan again. John, the signal sounds better, old man. Go ahead.
Thanks very much for letting me back on. Your earlier talk about dark matter and dark energy, we hear about this a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of curious what level of research on this matter is underway and what progress, if any, is going on about it.
Yeah.
I mean, we always hear that we don't know anything, but we don't really hear, you know, whether there's any chance of knowing anything
right.
within any reasonable future.
Yeah. So for dark matter, they are definitely looking into this. There are detectors underground, these big vats of xenon and stuff, and they're basically trying to look for dark matter particles that are passing through the Earth to interact with this material. And these experiments have been going on for years, and we haven't had any interactions. We haven't seen anything yet. So what they're really doing is they're kind of narrowing down the parameter space for what dark matter could be. We're getting a better and better idea of what it must be, but we haven't actually seen it in action yet. We haven't actually detected a particle or a thing. Dark energy is more theoretical. It's more we're working out the mathematics and trying to figure out, you know, any sense of what it could be. That is much more mysterious than the dark matter.
And it may not even really be a thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have observations. We see the galaxies moving away. We know the universe is expanding, and something has to cause that, and we're just calling that something dark energy. Okay. What it is, I don't know.
Well, what are the two or three prominent theories regarding dark matter?
Okay, well, first you have to know why we say that it's there and why we're so sure. Dark matter is stuff that's not giving off any light and it's not reflecting any light and it has no visible presence, but it has a gravitational presence. So how do we know it's there? Because the way the Milky Way, our galaxy, spins, we're spinning as if we were a solid vinyl disc. We're not spinning faster in the center the way Mercury goes around the sun fast and Pluto goes around the sun slow. We're not doing that. And this indicates that there's about six times more gravity in our galaxy than can be explained by all the planet, all the stars, all any black holes, all the dust, everything. Hmm. And wait, that's not the end of it. It's worse. And this is what let astronomers first realize that dark matter was there. This is going back. We're going back half a century and more now. This is not a new thing.
Yeah.
Is that when we look at galaxy groups, and this started with our own local group of galaxies, we see that the motion of all the galaxies in our group and in all other groups, they're moving around each other at a rate that shows that there's also about six times more gravity there than anything that we can actually see. So we call this gravity, this whatever stuff is producing this gravity that can't be seen, that's what's called dark matter. Now, as to what it is, that's another story.
All right.
Dark energy is simpler. Didn't exist until 1998. When suddenly we unexpectedly we saw, as Valerie just said, that the universe was expanding, inflating at an impossibly fast rate, that had to mean, and this is insane, that empty space has an anti-gravity ability, that the emptier space is, the more it pushes stuff away. So we call this pushing force, this anti-gravity force, dark energy. That's all we know about it. It's really mysterious. So
all right, let's,
that's the story about both.
Let's quickly go to Sheikh in Loudonville. You're on.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, what is the difference between new moon and lunar eclipse? And the other question is, if the universe, you know, we know not if the universe is expanding, so then the galaxies should be running away from one another. So how come some of them are colliding?
All right, we have about 1 minute
I'll do the first
here.
One and you do the second
one. 1 minute,
good,
guys.
Good. Yeah, that'll play to our strengths. A lot of people think that when they see shadowing on the moon, it's from Earth's shadow. I've heard a lot of people, when they see a half moon, say, well, that's Earth's shadow on the moon that's making half of it dark. No, it's shadowing itself. Anytime you just hold up a ball outdoors in sunlight, you'll see half the ball looks dark because that's the half that's not in the sun. That's the half of it is not in the sun. So your question about what's the difference between a lunar eclipse and new moon is just that time when the sun is shining on the far side of the moon that we're not seeing. We're facing the dark side. Lunar eclipse is the moon going into our shadow.
All right.
So it's kind of opposite. Part two of the question?
20 yeah. seconds.
And in your galaxy comment, the answer again is gravity, right? The galaxies that are close to us are caught in the gravitational pull of the Milky Way. The ones further out, this dark energy is taking over.
Wow. You had 10 seconds to spare.
Look at what's the website? I'm good at this.
What's the website for Dudley Observatory?
DudleyObservatory.org.
All right. And Bob, you working on anything you want to talk about in 1 second?
No.
All right. Fair enough. Support comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, careersintransitionllc.com. Studio KTM Organic Hair Salon, featuring individual attention in a private environment with cutter and colorist Kristen Marquette using Naturalique organic products, studiokTM.com. Mass Mocha, North Adams, Massachusetts, presenting Berkshire County's Misty Blues with Gina Coleman December 6th and Caribbean-infused Brooklyn band Del Sonido December 7th, massmocha.org. And CEFQ, with more than 30 locations in the Capital Region, committed to providing deposit and loan options to meet its member needs. CEFQ, changing lives every day, CEFQ.com. Well, thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for stopping by today. Thank you all for listening and for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered today by Jim Harrison. Our producer is Jimmy the Hammer Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, oh boy, you ever seen those air fryers? They frighten the daylights out of me, but cookbook authors Bruce Weinstein and Mark Scarborough will be here, and hopefully they won't bring one. We'll find out tomorrow at 2. Stand by for the Capital Connection.